Men, The Sad Young Men, Rod W. Houghton and Herbert W. Edwards. No aspect of life in the 20s has been more commented upon and sensationally romanticized than the so-called revolt of the younger generation. The slightest mention of the decade brings nostalgic recollections to the middle-aged and curious questionings by the young. Memories of the deliciously illicit thrill of the first visit to a speakeasy, of the brave denunciation of Puritan morality, and of the fashionable experimentations in amour in the parked sedan on a country road. Questions about the naughty jazzy parties, the flask-toting shelk, and the moral and stylistic vagaries of the flapper and the drugstore cowboy. Were young people really so wild? Present-day students asked their parents and teachers. Was there really a younger generation problem? The answers to such inquiries must, of necessity, be yes and no. Yes, because the business of growing up is always accompanied by a younger generation problem. No, because what seems so wild, irresponsible and immoral in social behaviour at the time can now be seen in perspective as being something considerably less sensational than the degeneration of our jazz-mad youth. Actually, the revolt of the young people was a logical outcome of conditions in the age. First of all, it must be remembered that the rebellion was not confined to the United States, but affected the entire Western world as a result of the aftermath of the first serious war in a century. Second, in the United States, it was reluctantly realized by some, subconsciously if not openly, that our country was no longer isolated in either politics or tradition, and that we had reached an international stature that would forever prevent us from retreating behind the artificial rules of a provincial morality or the geographical protection of our two bordering oceans. The rejection of Victorian gentility was, in any case, inevitable. The booming of American industry, with its gigantic, roaring factories, its corporate impersonality, and its large-scale aggressiveness, no longer left any room for the code of political behaviour and well-bred morality fashioned in a quieter and less competitive age. War or no war, as the generations passed, it became increasingly difficult for our young people to accept standards of behaviour that bore no relationship to the bustling business medium in which they were expected to battle for success. The war acted merely as a catalytic agent in this breakdown of the Victorian social structure, and, by precipitating our young people into a pattern of mass murder, it released their inhibited violent energies, which, after the shooting was over, were turned in both Europe and America to the destruction of an obsolescent 19th century society. Thus, in a changing world, youth was faced with the challenge of bringing our mores up to date. But at the same time, it was tempted, in America at least, to escape its responsibilities and retreat behind an air of naughty alcoholic sophistication and the pose of bohemian immorality. The faddishness, the wild spending of money on transitory pleasures and momentary novelties, the hectic air of gaiety, the experimentation and sensation, sex, drugs, alcohol, perversions, were all part of the pattern of escape, an escape made possible by a general prosperity and a post-war fatigue with politics, economic restrictions, and international responsibilities. Prohibition afforded the young the additional opportunity of making their pleasures illicit, and the much-publicized orgies and defiant manifestos of the intellectuals crowding into Greenwich Village gave them a pattern and a philosophic defense for their escapism. And, like most escapist sprees, this one lasted until the money ran out, until the crash of the world economic structure at the end of the decade called the party to a halt and forced the revellers to sober up and face the problems of the new age. The rebellion started with World War I, the prolonged stalemate of 1915 to 1916, the increasing insolence of Germany toward the United States, and our official reluctance to declare our status as a belligerent, were intolerable to many of our idealistic citizens, and, with typical American adventurousness, enhanced somewhat by the strenuous jingoism of Theodore Roosevelt, our young men began to enlist under foreign flags. In the words of Joe Williams in John Dos Passos, USA, they wanted to get into the fun before the whole thing turned belly up. The military service in 1916 to 1917 was still a romantic occupation. The young men of college age in 1917 knew nothing of modern warfare. The strife of 1861 to 1865 had popularly become, in motion picture and history, a magnolia-scented soap opera, while the 100 days fracas with Spain in 1898 had dissolved into a one-sided victory at Manila and a cinematic charge up San Juan Hill. Furthermore, there were enough high school assembly orators proclaiming the character-forming force of the strenuous life to convince more than enough otherwise sensible boys that service in the European conflict would be of great personal value, in addition to being idealistic and exciting. Accordingly, they began to join the various armies in increasing numbers, the intellectuals in the ambulance corps, others in the infantry, merchant marine, or wherever else they could find a place. Those who were reluctant to serve in a foreign army talked excitedly about preparedness, occasionally considering joining the National Guard, and rushed to enlist when we finally did enter the conflict. So tremendous was the storming of recruitment centres that harassed sergeants actually pleaded with volunteers to go home and wait for the draft. But since no self-respecting person wanted to suffer the disgrace of being drafted, the enlistment craze continued unabated. Naturally, the spirit of carnival and the enthusiasm for high military adventure were soon dissipated once the eager young men had received a good taste of 20th century warfare. To their lasting glory, they fought with distinction, but it was a much altered group of soldiers who returned from the battlefields in 1919. Especially was this true of the college contingent, whose idealism had led them to enlist early, and who had generally seen a considerable amount of action. To them, it was bitter to return to a hometown virtually untouched by the conflict, where citizens still talked with the naive 4th of July bombast they themselves had been guilty of 2 or 3 years earlier. It was even more bitter to find that their old jobs had been taken by the stay-at-homes, that business was suffering a recession that prevented the opening up of new jobs, and that veterans were considered problem children and less desirable than non-veterans for whatever business opportunities that did exist. Their very homes were often uncomfortable to them. They had outgrown town and families and had developed a sudden bewildering world weariness which neither they nor their relatives could understand. Their energies had been whipped up and their naivety destroyed by the war, and now, in sleepy gopher prairies all over the country, they were being asked to curb those energies and resume the pose of self-deceiving Victorian innocence that they now felt to be as outmoded as the notion that their fighting had made the world safe for democracy. And, as if hometown conditions were not enough, the returning veteran also had to face the sodden, Napoleonic cynicism of Versailles, the hypocritical do-goodism of Prohibition, and the smug patriotism of the war profiteers. Something in the tension-ridden youth of America had to give, and after a short period of bitter resentment, it gave in the form of a complete overthrow of genteel standards of behaviour. Greenwich Village set the pattern. Since the 70s, a dwelling place for artists and writers who settled there because living was cheap,
the village had long enjoyed a dubious reputation for bohemianism and eccentricity. It had also harboured enough major writers, especially in the decade before World War I, to support its claim to being the intellectual centre of the nation. After the war, it was only natural that hopeful young writers, their minds and pens inflamed against war, babbitry and puritanical gentility, should flock to the traditional artistic centre, where living was still cheap in 1919, to pour out their newfound creative strength, to tear down the old world, to flout the morality of their grandfathers, and to give all to art, love, and sensation. Soon, they found their imitators among the non-intellectuals. As it became more and more fashionable throughout the country for young persons to defy the law and the conventions, and to add their own little matchsticks to the conflagration of flaming youth, it was Greenwich Village that fanned the flames. Bohemian living became a fad. Each town had its fast set, which prided itself on its unconventionality, although in reality, this self-conscious unconventionality was rapidly becoming a standard feature of the country club class, and its less affluent imitators throughout the nation. Before long, the movement had become officially recognised by the pulpit, which denounced it, by the movies and magazines, which made it attractively naughty while pretending to denounce it, and by advertising, which obliquely encouraged it by selling everything from cigarettes to automobiles, with the implied promise that their owners would be rendered sexually irresistible. Younger brothers and sisters of the war generation, who had been playing with marbles and dolls during the battles of Belleau Wood and Chateau Thierry, and who had suffered no real disillusionment or sense of loss, now began to imitate the manners of their elders and play with the toys of vulgar rebellion. Their parents were shocked, but before long they found themselves and their friends adopting the new gaiety. By the middle of the decade, the wild party had become as commonplace a factor in American life as the flapper, the Model T, or the Dutch colonial home in Floral Heights. Meanwhile, the true intellectuals were far from flattered. What they had wanted was an America more sensitive to art and culture, less avid for material gain, and less susceptible to standardization. Instead, their ideas had been generally ignored, while their behavior had contributed to that standardization by furnishing a pattern of bohemianism, and had become as conventionalized as a rotary luncheon. As a result, their dissatisfaction with their native country, already acute upon their return from the war, now became even more intolerable. Flaming diatribes poured from their pens, denouncing the materialism and what they considered to be the cultural boobery of our society. An important book, rather grandiosely entitled Civilization in the United States, written by 30 intellectuals under the editorship of J. Harold Stearns, was the rallying point of sensitive persons disgusted with America. The burden of the volume was that the best minds in the country were being ignored, that art was unappreciated, and that big business had corrupted everything. Journalism was a mere adjunct to money-making, politics were corrupt and filled with incompetence and crooks, and American family life, so devoted to making money and keeping up with the Joneses, that it had become joyless, patterned, hypocritical, and sexually inadequate. These defects would disappear if only creative art were allowed to show the way to better things. But since the country was blind and deaf to everything save the glint and ring of the dollar, there was little remedy for the sensitive mind but to emigrate to Europe, where they do things better. By the time Civilization in the United States was published, 1921, most of its contributors had taken their own advice and were living abroad, and many more of the artistic and would-be artistic had followed suit. It was in their defiant, but generally short-lived European expatriation that our leading writers of the 20s learned to think of themselves, in the words of Gertrude Stein, as the lost generation. In no sense a movement in itself, the lost generation attitude nevertheless acted as a common denominator of the writing of the times. The war and the cynical power politics of Versailles had convinced these young men and women that spirituality was dead. They felt as stunned as John Andrews, the defeated aesthete in Don's Passos' Three Soldiers, as rootless as Hemingway's Wandering Alcoholics in The Sun Also Rises. Besides Stein, Dos Passos and Hemingway, there were Lewis Mumford, Ezra Pound, Sherwood Anderson, Matthew Josephson, J. Harold Stearns, T.S. Eliot, E.E. Cummings, Malcolm Cowley, and many other novelists, dramatists, poets, and critics, who tried to find their souls in the Antibes and on the Left Bank, who directed sad and bitter blasts at their native land, and who, almost to a man, drifted back within a few years out of sheer homesickness to take up residence on coastal islands and in New England farmhouses, and to produce works ripened by the tempering of an older, more sophisticated society. For actually, the lost generation was never lost. It was shocked, uprooted for a time, bitter, critical, rebellious, iconoclastic, experimental, often absurd, more often misdirected, but never lost. A decade that produced, in addition to the writers listed above, such figures as Eugene O'Neill, Edna St. Vincent Millay, F. Scott Fitzgerald, William Faulkner, Sinclair Lewis, Stephen Vincent Benet, Hart Crane, Thomas Wolfe, and innumerable others could never be written off as sterile, even by itself in a moment of self-pity. The intellectuals of the 20s, the sad young men, as F. Scott Fitzgerald called them, cursed their luck, but didn't die, escaped, but voluntarily returned, flayed the Babbitts, but loved their country, and in so doing gave the nation the liveliest, freshest, most stimulating writing in its literary experience. From Rhetoric and Literature by P. Joseph Canavan.